This is the final part of episode 8 on the second half of the Functions of the Executive by Chester Barnard. If you're just tuning in, please go and listen to the previous part first, as this is a direct continuation of that discussion.
Barnard talks about the actions and activities involved in the executive process. I think one of the things that struck me about the executive process is Barnard again talks about efficiency in a slightly different way. This is my understanding than he did earlier in the book. He says the efficiency of an organization results from control. My paraphrase: controls at the point of exchange of output and income. At the periphery of the organization, and the controlling, managing coordination of internal production. He says the exchange is about distribution, coordination. Exchange is about distribution, and coordination is about creativity. So I thought that was an interesting insight about coordination. There's this element of creativity involved in coordination.
I had a question mark on that.
So why don't you say what your question is, and then we can talk a little bit more about that.
No, I just couldn't see it in reality. So I would have liked an example.
Can you give an example of or explain more about how you don't see it? What confused you?
The creativity part. I was a bit confused. That was my major aspect. I'm presuming that coordination is an idea. Like, the way you achieve coordination depends from organization to organization, but I wasn't sure that was the meaning of it. I personally was surprised seeing this idea of coordination with this idea of creative factor, to see them coupled in this way together.
I was too. I think that's a good observation that they you might not think they go very well. In fact, I had written down on page 255, he says, "This philosophy of giving as little as possible and getting as much as possible in the other man's values is the root of bad customer relations, bad labor relations, et cetera, et cetera." But he doesn't go much further than that. He just says it's bad to do that.
I'm presuming that my concern boils down to this general idea that Barnard uses certain words in a certain way. And as we said before, he doesn't really expand on them. And sometimes they're borrowed from everyday language, so you have a certain meaning, but it's not the meaning that he's giving to it.
I think it has something to do with that, because I think a lot of the terms, or many times some of his more complex and interesting ideas, you have to try to determine from context what you think he might mean, and so you have some other options. So there can be some divergence. So one thing I want to add to about the creative efficiency, I'm not saying it explains it, but it was where it was made a little bit more sense to me. So on page 256, he talks about what creative efficiency is, and in this very indirect, circuitous way that I sum up as all-around management, executive perspective, and then, this is a quotation, determining the strategic factors of creative cooperation. So I guess this now we're going back to we were talking about this, subsume yourself into the organization and you become part of the organization. Now I think we're talking about more personal things that are unique to the individual, but it's really not clear to me, other than saying that these are essentially non-technical factors.
So my question is, how can coordination be creative?
Maybe it's supposed to say generative.
Generative.
So creative, not creative as
artistic,
thinking outside the box and coming up with not artistic, but something that is being created.
Yeah,
so generative,
or opens new possibilities. That could be.
I think maybe narrower. Maybe it's just something that produces something.
Okay.
Then I totally misunderstood. You could have used another word.
Well, no, I may be completely off. I'm not claiming legitimacy for my interpretation. It's just a suggestion, given that the artistic interpretation seems to be problematic. But if you look at it more literally, more etymologically, then creative as that which causes something to be or become.
Oh, it, so creation,
so coordination,
as opposed to okay.
Yes. Right. Yes.
So, yeah. So let me give you an example of what I think he might mean from my work life. And I'm not saying I completely understand it. I'm just saying part of this did resonate with me when he was talking about coordination being about creativity. So in many, many complex undertakings, you have people from different organizations have to function together and get parts of their organization to mesh well, to get to engage in cooperative enterprises. Bernard doesn't really talk about that, cooperation across enterprises or across organizations, but it does exist, and I've some of the more difficult work I've done involves that. So what I found out in a couple circumstances was that if you did the normal formal communication approach, you'd go to somebody at your level in the other organization who knew about what was happening, understood what was supposed to happen, and you would say, okay, I need you to do this, or you need to be ready to support my organization on this day, this way, there's many ways of doing that. You can do it very formally with what we call memorandums of understanding and agreement, where it actually spells all the rules out and stuff. And many times that does function, but it's generally not enough. And you get to this point where you say, okay, we're going to do this activity is going to occur in 2 days, and you need to show up with this many people, and they need to be ready to do this, and here's what the action is going to occur. I found out that the people at the working level either never were told or got this very garbled version of it. And I'm not talking it was a really complicated plan where me just writing it down would have made it easier. Maybe that would have been the case, but it would have been very cumbersome. And so I found out many times I couldn't. So it came to people from my organization showed up and the other organization wasn't ready. And then I tried again, the next day through my counterpart, and it didn't work. And so I finally started walking around the working spaces where the people who actually had to execute these activities worked, and started talking to them, and they had no idea that I'd been communicating this two separate times to try to get them to do something, and they were perfectly happy to do it. They just weren't getting the information through their what we call the chain of command or their hierarchy. So I started to get creative because I thought, well, my success is hostage to these people's organizational system and system of communication. It's not working very well. So I would go to people at the working level and say, right, here's this activity that we have planned. Here's what your organization needs to do. I'm not telling you what to do because I'm not authorized to do that, but I'm telling you I'm going to need this kind of support, and I'm sure your leadership, I kind of winked at it, I'm sure your leadership will tell you this. And then, sure enough, they would actually get prepared and do stuff. And because I'd already told their boss, I didn't get in trouble. I said, no, by the way, I'm not giving you orders, so you decide how to go do this. But that way they didn't go to their boss and say, hey, this Ralph guy is telling me to go do stuff, and who is he? And they were actually, because they understood the purpose and what we're trying to get accomplished, they would just do it. And then that got so good at one time, one of the senior, what we call a line leader, a person at the working level, came to me one time and said, don't even waste time talking to my boss. Just tell me what you want and we'll go do it. And so it just told me it was working very well. And I would tell, it's counterintuitive that that's the way you would go do it. But I actually had to tell his boss so I couldn't get in trouble for not communicating with him. But it was basically useless. Everything I told him, it didn't either didn't happen, or he was doing it some different way that made it impossible to go execute this. But when I taught the people at the working level, it worked wonderfully. And then they would also tell me when it was difficult for them to do or how I had to modify the plan. I mean, I got all sorts of great information that way. So I think that's an aspect of being creative that I tell junior executives today, sometimes that's what you have to do, but you have to do it in a way that's creative and informal and to get done what you need to get done. So kind of a long-winded example, but I think that's kind of resonated with me, is sort of that creative aspect.
Well, on page 257, he tries to elaborate what he means by the creative, which underlines a poor choice of wording again. He says that being creative is a phenomenological aspect, and that it consists of feeling physical, biological, economic, social, personal, and spiritual utilities involved in conjunction with strategic factors of cooperation. So it is literally feeling the organization, I think, whether you're in tune with it or not. Not sure why the word creative was there, but I think he essentially means being, well, coming back to what we said about organizations as separate entities, he very much here seems to imply that creative coordination has to do with being consciously or in some other very immediate way one with the organization in some capacity.
And you're probably right about that. It's just frustrating. He's not clear on that, and it goes back to what you said about the use of language and such. So lots of room for interpretation there.
He does say that this general executive process is not intellectual. Its important aspect is aesthetic and moral.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite sentences in the whole chapter.
Yeah, I had that one too.
Which is also coincidentally a very tangible advice to give people. Feel your organization and be morally upstanding.
Right.
But the morality bit is important in this text, and the next chapter is mainly about that.
All right. So I think now in chapter 17, the discusses the nature of the executive responsibility. And I was very impressed there early in the chapter. He says, leadership is basically the power to inspire cooperative personal decisions or decisions by creating faith, right? And that goes, I think that's a nice follow on from what you said, Demetrius, about you become one with the organization, and that's part of what this process of creating, maybe that's a better way to say it, creating process comes from. It's creating faith. I think that's very powerful insight.
I think faith is a key word. And
yes, absolutely.
I can't resist on this note not to go to the very end of the chapter.
It's okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
All right. So this is how...
Which page?
284. So okay. This is how amazing a writer Barnard is. So the last sentence of the chapter on the nature of executive responsibility, it's profound beyond... any reasonable expectations from a management text. So I will set the scene so that you can get a full appreciation of what's going on here. So imagine rolling fields, sunset, glory is in the air, follows a hero who is on an epic journey to be one with the organization or whatever. Possibly carrying a sword, possibly on a horse. And a deep voiceover says,
so amongst those who cooperate, the things that are seen are moved by the things unseen. Out of the void comes the spirit that shapes the ends of men.
Yeah, out of the void comes the spirit that shapes the ends of men. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's like an epic. There's some kind of Norse epic or something.
Yes.
Well, so
yeah, scratch my image. Imagine a Viking on a longboat.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly. And he's coming into shore with a flag in the background. Yeah, so he sets this up on the prior page where he says, executive responsibility is that capacity of leaders by which reflecting attitudes, ideals, hopes, derived largely from without themselves, they are compelled to bind the wills of men to the accomplishment of purposes beyond their immediate ends, beyond their times. Holy cow.
Right, so you can see Bernard was writing well into the night at this point.
Yeah, and several glasses of scotch later, I would imagine. Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Very epic.
It is. It is.
I was thinking about Star Wars.
So Demetrius and I, we were thinking Lord of the Rings, but Star Wars will work as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. The flying letters through space. This is ideal.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good one. I think this does tie together well with faith. I think this does tie well with the notion of faith. And the note I wrote to myself in the margin in the early part of the book, but it just sums it up well, is that faith is essentially the glue that sustains cooperation. That's what I think he's trying to get at there. And so kind of epic language, but that was the bottom line for me.
Well, I would agree with you more so than I am going to if he didn't use such mythical language, because this makes me think that... it's about virtue rather than faith. There is an extremely compelling normative aspect to all this pseudo-epic talk.
I think they're compatible because we're talking about attitudes, ideals, hopes, you know, things that
binding people together. Of course, it's not the difference of kind, yeah, but rather of degree.
Yeah, I'm with you. Mine is probably the lowercase version. You know, the faith sustains cooperation. That's probably the lowercase. And at the end of the chapter, he basically builds this crescendo where you had the nice visual image there. So I think you are right. That is the larger area where he's going. I mean, I just love that. Attitudes, ideals, and hopes. Goodness gracious.
I know. It's almost the sacred mission of the executive to lead the organization into this almost a make or break moment within its history where everyone will pull together within the purpose in their respective units and they will persevere and they will prevail and everyone's going to be awesome and
right for purposes that are timeless, right? Timeless, holy
yes, timeless and spaceless. And
but I was also go ahead, finish.
I don't think I was saying anything of substance, so feel free.
Okay,
oh, they're talking about self-critique.
Okay, then I'll add something. I was thinking that maybe in between the lines, there's also this idea of sacrifice. I mean, the idea of the myth of the hero is often, regardless of the literary citations we've done, is always accompanied by the idea of sacrificing himself. And we have mentioned previously that the executive, in some ways, sacrifices his own individuality to become one entire thing with the organization. I'm not sure if it's stretching it because this part is.
I don't think it's
very high pitched for me.
I think it's very consistent. I think that's a good connection you drew.
I thought about this.
No, it's true. It's not just the executive who sacrifices. You as an individual, at any level of the organization, you sacrifice or suspend, at the very least, yourself in order to be in an organization where you are not an individual.
I think that applies in organizations. Bernard had experience with this talking about, but one of the things I was thinking about when you were saying that was that that's kind of a clash in organizations now, and there's quite a bit of research on this, about the conflict between Generation X and Y people in organizations, coming into organizations, and the baby boomers, and this kind of clash of visions and ideals and hopes that makes it difficult. When I was starting out my working career, there was this very strong pressure to conform and subsume and join the organization and subscribe to its ideals and those kinds of things. And I didn't really question that much. I just felt like, okay, well, here's this. I have to work and mold myself. And a lot of people come into organizations today and they expect the organization to change for them. And or they expect it to be more responsive to what their needs are. And I'm not saying it's bad. It's just different. In fact, there's many people in my organizations when I was working that they consider that offensive and a problem. And these people are just, they have all these demands and they're not willing to take the time to learn. And I said, well, they're maybe more attuned to what they need to learn or what they want out of it. But it's kind of one of the bigger clashes in organizational development.
Yeah. Kids these days and their postmodernism.
There you go. That's a nice way to sum it up. That's all I had for chapter 17.
Yes, it is a very nostalgic chapter with the where this modernist idea of the goal, the purpose, the hero, the hero's journey that is not individual hero, as you know, I want to imply that it's all a nihilistic void now, but certainly there's more emphasis on self and personality, which is great because we see less of this interchangeability and this almost organizational patriotism, which in words of Voltaire, the virtue of the vicious.
Right.
One thing I do want to mention in chapter 17 still is that it seems that Bernard is introducing yet another metaphysical entity into his system. So we had the organization as the first one of these because it's an entity in its own right. Then we had the personality of the organization. And now we seem to have this Hegelian spirit of times, the spirit of history, because just above the, in the paragraph just above the one that I read with the silly voice, he talks about, I'm not going to read that, it's far too good, and listeners should go and check it out for themselves. But he talks about this zeitgeist that will, to a degree of inevitability, cause the organization to drift in a particular direction, and there is not much that anyone can do about that, and that's just something that needs to be faced head on. And I mean, this is part of the, this is certainly an element for the heroics that he is describing. But it does, on a more analytical note, introduce this notion that the wider environment within which organizations exist, the economy, the competitive environment, the society, you know, the world, technology, all that sort of things, they are outside, generally, of the scope of control of the executives and the organizations. And it almost precludes this idea that one cannot fight the environment or resist the change, and there needs to be a degree of adaptation in order to continue operating. And he, of course, correlates with his understanding of effectiveness of the organization, which has to do with the purpose, and kind of it's sprinkled here and there in the text. But maybe it's, again, reading too much into him, which is hard not to, given the lexical choices made here. Yes. But it's almost this romanticization of what is now evolving into in the project-based organization literature of the environment is fluid, and so you must be too.
Right. I think a lot of organizational theory and practice has evolved, and I don't want to say beyond, but sort of in a different direction. And the other thing I was going to say, what you're talking about there is this sort of this inside-outside view of organizations is consistent with his wording on incentives, right? Because material incentives are so influenced by the outside world, you have to look at other ways to get people to cooperate or to encourage them and sustain their cooperation than just pure material incentives. So I think that's entirely consistent with the point you were making.
Right. So one chapter to go, which is the conclusion.
Right. And I didn't have a lot in chapter 18, just because chapter 18 strikes me as a lot of sweeping assertions that are not very well explained. So I had this really strong feeling that Miranda talked about where you want to say, what do you mean by that? You know, go into that more. And the example I will give you of that is it's one of his points, number 13. An increasing degree of cooperation implies an increasing moral complexity. That's a really interesting idea, but he doesn't explain it any further. So I'm kind of left wondering what he meant by that. And a lot of the conclusions were like that for me.
Right. No, I agree. These are book titles, essentially, that he's listing here.
Or research projects.
Yeah. So it should have been named Suggestions for Further Research.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than conclusions, because he's not concluding anything. And if anything, he sort of seems to, possibly writing at the same time of day as he did the previous chapter, he seems to come to a realization that he is way out of his depth, and it's just, all right, this is too much. Here's a couple of things that I sort of meditated on, but generally it is a question for philosophy and religion, which is the very last sentence of this chapter.
Right.
Well, I do agree with this general sense of the conclusions that are these sweeping statements that are quite vague, and that if they would be very, very, very interesting to unpack and to figure out what he actually means, because a lot of the notions are quite general. At the same time, they are so vague that depending on the angle you take, you could say, yes, it is true, I agree, but no, not really. So I had a lot of question marks, but not having enough detail and not having enough specifics in terms of meanings and so on, I didn't know where to start.
No, and he seems to identify faith as the cornerstone of this entire project. So we went through almost 300 pages of him unpacking everything from an individual into the physical, biological, and social aspects, and even unpacking division of labor into spatial and temporal in addition to the regular elements. And all of that, just to conclude that in order for my system to hold together or to have any explanatory value, you just have to assume that people have faith in the entire project, that is the organization.
Yeah, same here. I wasn't convinced by a lot of that.
And that's a bit flaccid.
To me, it's not convincing.
But I don't, like Miranda, I don't know if it's right or wrong. He just hasn't given me enough info to draw a stronger conclusion. Like, so that's why it's kind of weak, felt weak.
I think what we could have done, I mean, I don't regret reading this book, and I mentioned repeatedly that
I think it was good. Yeah.
Possibly one of my...
It's very, very interesting.
Okay. Bad way to start for something that I'm going to compliment. Basically, this is an excellent book, and I mentioned in part one of this episode that given enough time, if you're in a long flight or if at some point in time audiobook version becomes available, this is something that needs to be consumed, because it covers so much, and it covers a lot of that in very unorthodox ways that actually do make you think and do make you consider what you knew about the organization studies and management and so on and so forth.
Powerful insights that really aren't expressed in other forums. So yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, but it seems that we could have just read the opening quote and the finishing quote in order to kind of get where this is going to go, in which direction, what is the trajectory. Because you recall he started with Aristotle's quote from Metaphysics, but he's finishing with Plato. So by the absence of I sense I need to elaborate.
No, it's good, but just yes, do elaborate. I think that would be helpful.
So Aristotle was
please, this is your area.
It really isn't, but anyway,
he's gonna make it his own for now.
Yes. There's no one to dispute me, so
exactly.
So you have to listen to me, but don't switch this off. Basically, Aristotle was notoriously different from Plato in that he conducted a lot more analytical investigations of empirical things. So the traditional dichotomy between the two, especially as expressed in the School of Athens painting, is that Plato was all about heads in the sky, and Aristotle was all about kind of what we would probably more recognize as science these days, which isn't true. And listen to Peter Adamson's History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps, early episodes for that. But he proceeds in the same... and Plato was more about this metaphysical philosophy. So you have the forms that then things in the world partake in forms, and that's how they gain their characteristics. So it's very broad and abstract. Barnard does the same. He starts the book with these hyper-analytical descriptions of things. I mean, the half of the entire first part is unpacking a human being in a completely unnecessary way. Not in general unnecessary, but to the remainder of the argument. There is no reason why it should have taken this long to say that people have social aspects and that they have a body. You know, that can be assumed, I suppose.
Yeah, he does go to extreme length over there.
Right. So he kind of proceeds with other aspects, and as the book goes on, it becomes more common to see these philosophical throw-ins where he just makes a statement that isn't supported or even not necessarily fitting within whatever he's trying to explain. So he goes from more analytical towards more metaphysical, which seems to follow in a broad way if you aligned Aristotle to Plato in this reverse order.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I see that in 16, 17, and 18. I absolutely see him going from this kind of concrete specific
okay, I get it.
To the
yeah,
much
yeah.
more general high level.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And 18, it really isn't, it's not really conclusions of what he's presented. It's more like implications, or like you said, ideas for further research. And all right, it's kind of interesting, but I was like Miranda, I'd like to have a longer conversation with him about where he was going with some of that stuff in 18.
I don't know if that helped anyone of our listeners to understand this book.
Yeah, I thought it was very good actually, because it was a nice sort of philosophical way to sum up
some of my
own concerns. I'm not as well versed in philosophy as you are, so but I am familiar with the arguments that you're making. So yeah, that's a nice way to identify it, because that's actually what makes the front part of the book tedious. Is a bit tedious as he goes into all this detail. I thought this unnecessary detail of unpacking the human being just so we can get to this, you know, these other aspects of cooperation. I thought, oh yeah, that's a great way to say it. I hadn't quite seen it that way, but oh yeah, it's definitely there.
It's a good way of providing an overall picture of the entire book, something that maybe we missed out on having had so many episodes on and so many parts on the book.
But it is a rich work, and as Dimitri was saying, it was lots of things to talk about, lots of very interesting observations based on his experience of how organizations function, and ideas that you don't find in many other management texts. So I think I'm really glad we got a chance to talk about it.
So what are the functions of the executive?
Well, definitely to maintain the cooperative system. I got that part down.
Cooperative system via a good system of communication.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. Yeah,
the emphasis on communication is, I think, very pertinent. It's certainly something that struck me as that. Oh, so it's a lot about communication, which is seemingly obvious as quite a few things in management are. But to an equal extent, it's you know, as obvious as it is, yeah, it's also so frequently overlooked that people communicate, and that is pretty much the primary thing that they do.
Right.
So authority, knowledge, all that stuff, that's all down to communication. And Bernard is very aware of that, and he, I think, tries to make that the cornerstone of his agenda, but for some reason he changes it to faith later.
Yeah, interesting way to sum up.
Maybe if he stuck with the language, this would have been more concrete. But, you know, that's what we're here for.
Precise.
Yes, exactly.
And that concludes episode 8 on the functions of the executive by Chester Bernard. Thank you for listening. Next week, we are going to release a summary covering the entire book, which we discussed in episodes 7 and 8. If you enjoyed this episode and like our podcast, please tell your friends and colleagues about us, get in touch on Twitter and Facebook, and tell us what you think, and leave us a positive review on iTunes. Even a brief one can help new people find us there. Thank you for joining us, and I hope to see you next time, as we look at the famous Hawthorne studies by Elton Mayo and Associates, here on Talking About Organizations.